This podcast is brought to you by the Clare and Gilbert Valleys Council. Welcome to another episode of the Clare Valley Podcast, bringing you the latest news, issues, community events and characters from right across the Clare and Gilbert Valleys. I'm your host, Annabelle Homer. This episode is jam-packed and I'm so excited to bring it to you this month. Who can remember the Ash Wednesday bushfires? February 16th marks the 40th anniversary of those fires, a devastating fire event that swept through parts of Victoria, Adelaide Hills and the lower southeast, as well as here in the Clare Valley. It's been described as one of the worst natural disasters that has ever hit our state. You'll hear stories from some Clare Valley locals who fought the fires, lost their homes and their livelihoods, and in some cases took years to get back on track.
Quite heartbreaking at times, and at one stage we thought we had it quite well contained.
Unfortunately, all of our sheep got cooked in the fire, they died.
But then, of course, the winds changed and came back again. That's how we lost it all.
Also, we're going to recognise a young man who was awarded Young Citizen of the Year at the Australia Day Award breakfast. His name is Angus Holland and he tells an inspiring tale about his mullet and his footy team. But first, let's get the latest from Council Headquarters with CEO of the Clare and Gilbert Valleys Council, Dr. Helen McDonald. Firstly, a lot of news coming out of Auburn with further discussions on the Auburn Streetscape Plan, a project to upgrade the aesthetic nature of Auburn's main street. One of the major recommendations from the designers is to underground the power lines, which Council has agreed in principle to do, subject to grant funding.
There's an opportunity to partner with SA Power because they have a program called PLIC, which is provides funding to underground power lines. So that was the first decision because that had implications for the rest of the design work. There's no point doing any further design works or implementing the design until you do the undergrounding of the power line. So the council's in principle decided that it would like to do it, but it's all obviously depend on funding, and that's the same with the rest of the works, which is tree planting, making look more attractive, upgrading footpaths, making them compliant for pushers and wheelchairs. The same for Vincent Street, which is where some of the major heritage buildings are. They're the kinds of works that are proposed.
It's about a $6 million project, isn't it? But if the grant funding came into play, it could halve that cost.
Absolutely, yep. Yeah. If council had to come up with the $6 million, well, I doubt very much it would agree to do that. If we can get grant funding, which is probably for this particular project more likely than we wouldn't. So there's state grants and obviously SA Power grants. So the chances of getting that funding are quite high.
It's closed for this year, though, this coming financial year, so it won't be applicable until the following financial year, I understand.
We're not in a position to do it anyway. So, yeah, it would more likely be a 3 to 4 year project, depending when it starts.
Staying in Auburn, the Auburn Community Development Committee wants to develop a raised area adjacent to the War Monument on King Street and Horrocks Highway. Dr. McDonald explains why it's important.
It's a plan that the Auburn community have had for quite a long time, particularly when they have Anzac Day ceremonies, because their war memorial is on the corner, becomes a little bit unsafe, and it's not easily for them to gather because the ground drops away behind into the park area. And so they've envisaged that having a platform essentially behind where the war memorial is, it'll provide standing space. And they've had the Auburn community group have already got designs and engineering drawings done for it. They've done fundraising. Obviously, planning approval is something that comes through council, and because it's council property, council needs to provide approval that something can be constructed on council land. In terms of the last council meeting, that was the decision that council had to make, was to provide approval for that to be constructed.
Council has been working with the Auburn community on the sale of the Auburn RSL Community Centre for the last few years. But what will happen to those funds when the sale goes through?
The sale of the RSL building, because it's on community land or public land, shall we say, there's a much longer process of sale. You can't just put it on the market. We have to get ministerial approval to sell it. So it takes, you know, 12 months at least to go just through the process to get permission to sell it, and then before you can put it on the market. because it's the RSL building, the RSL has made a request that as part of them combining with the Clare RSL group and their plans to be able to use the new Clare Sports Club facility as their meeting space, they were looking for some funds to contribute towards moving and tidying up and everything. Their request is to council that some of the money from the sale of the building could go to the RSL and not just stay within the Auburn community.
So $20,000 they would like to be provided to the RSL.
Yes. I wouldn't be surprised if we don't have issues selling it, because one of the challenges that we know in Auburn is the lack of retail space. I know, for example, recently there was a business that's just bought a house that was on the market right on Main North Road. That's not bought as a residential place. It's been bought to run a business out of. So
you're confident that it will sell?
Yeah, I don't think.
It's not going to be an empty building on the main street?
No, it won't be like some other communities. Generally, it's selling the building is not really a challenge. It's sometimes, you know, what you can sell it for.
With local government, there is a requirement in the Act that every new council has to review its strategic plan within 18 months of it being formed, so by mid-2024. So what is the council up to with the latest strategic plan?
I just think it's really important that council do that as soon as possible in the new term, and in particular have identified what are the key things that they think are important to deliver over the next 4 years. So my plan is to get councillors to focus on those things. Obviously, administration will provide council with some ideas, because there's ongoing projects which need to be completed or have been talked about for some time and need to be either considered and moved ahead, or no, we're not going to do it. And the councillors themselves may have ideas. So the focus for this plan, because we spent quite a lot of effort in the previous council getting a new document in place, which is very high level in terms of, you know, what are the objectives of the council. Now, certainly that will be reviewed, but the emphasis is going to be on the deliverables of the strategic plan, because I think that's what's important. I think that's what the community probably would like to know is, well, this is all very well, but what are you actually going to do to achieve those particular goals that you've got? So that's where the focus will be. And the purpose of trying to get it done in what a relatively tight timeframe is so that it can inform the budget and business plan for the next financial year. It's not going to be a perfect match, but hopefully it will be able to have some input into what ends up in the business plan and budget.
And part of the process, you're conducting a community survey, trying to gauge what the community wants from council or should be achieving?
Well, we've done the community survey before. It's an online survey, although we will print out copies and make them available at the council offices and the library. But the purpose is to, and we're trying to make it short because people get sick of doing long surveys, but to get a sense of the services that we're currently delivered and the level of satisfaction, but also things that people might think that additional services that they would like to see. So we try to keep it short. And
do you get much of a response, or have you got much of a response
previously
in the background?
Yes, we did. The interesting thing about the survey we did a couple of years ago was that there was a very clear indication that people wanted to have a green waste collection. Things like that are useful if council has been reluctant to make a decision. It can be helpful to give them confidence that that's what the community does want or doesn't want. Maybe something council's been talking about doing and the community go, no, don't want it. Yeah.
The survey is now available on council's website. If you fill it out, you will go into the draw for a $100 gift voucher to spend at the Clare Valley Wine, Food and Tourism Centre. Rates. Last year, 140 properties were changed from primary production to residential. It caused some controversy and saw residents object to the change. Since then, what's been the outcome to these objections?
As you indicated, there were 140 properties where we put them to the Valuer General for a review, because we were of the view that the land use that had been ascribed to it was potentially incorrect. And so of the 140, we had 38 objections lodged with council in terms of the changes to the land use, and there 26 of those have been successful. I think there's 8 outstanding. 9 outstanding, and 3 were no change. Out of 140, 38 objections is not a huge amount at all. And I think one of the interesting things that many of us learnt in that process was the keeping horses as a hobby, I suppose. So many people assume that would not be categorised as being primary production. It's not primary production, but horses sit in a strange recreational category and I think still become fall under primary production, which is interesting. Oh. I don't think any of us knew that.
Staying with land use, the Stanley Flat Code Amendment. In August last year, Council supported 30 hectares of land along White Hut Road to be rezoned from rural to rural neighbourhood. It's currently being used for cropping and grazing purposes. The land located to the west of the affected area is also zoned rural neighbourhood and has reached capacity. The Minister has approved this code amendment, but with some conditions, that the blocks need to be smaller.
The issue about this is the Minister pushed it back because the Minister's argument is that the blocks are too large. I mean, the argument is it's using up valuable farmland for residential. Interesting things. You can't have large blocks, but you can have lots of little ones, but you're still using up the same amount of land. So the challenge for regional councils is the smaller the blocks, there needs to be more infrastructure put in place, which places an extra burden on council because we end up with additional infrastructure that we have to maintain. Whereas if they're larger blocks, then generally there's very little infrastructure involved that from a council point of view that needs ongoing maintenance or even the cost to install. And we don't necessarily have the demand for small blocks. We have the demand for these larger rural living kind of blocks. So
has council gone back to the minister and put your case to the minister?
That's an ongoing process of trying to argue with the minister and the planning department about them needing to better understand what's required in rural areas. Because it works well in urban or metropolitan areas doesn't mean that it's effective in regional areas. You know, we need housing. People are prepared to build houses on larger blocks, but if you don't let them have larger blocks, then there's a good chance they won't actually build.
Turning our attention to the Australia Day Awards, which were held recently at Melrose Park.
Indeed.
A successful breakfast, I understand.
We changed the venue for the Clare event and it was very successful. It was a lovely day or lovely morning. Lake Hinchinbrook being full made the environment even more attractive and many, many people mentioned to myself and other members of council how lovely it was to have the lake full of water and to be in that environment where we've had the model engineers who always turn on a fabulous event and share their enthusiasm with young and old children.
And I understand that there's some people that mention that the lake should be full all the time.
Oh, yes, certainly was sent away with very big hints that people would like to see the lake full of water. And certainly it does add to the ambience of Melrose Park in the summertime. So if it's council's desire, then we'll certainly investigate how we can make that happen. The idea hasn't yet gone to council. Not only did we have a successful event in Clare, but there was events in Saddleworth and in Riverton and in Auburn. I understand that the Riverton event was very successful. I think they had 120 people at their event, which was a good turnout.
How many people attended the Clare event?
We had over 250 people register for the event, but I think there was a lot more people that actually turned up. I would say it was well over 300 people that attended.
Congratulations to all Australia Day Award recipients. In the Northern Region, the Australia Day Citizen of the Year Award went to Ronald Layton, Young Citizen of the Year, Angus Holland, Community Event of the Year, Clare Agricultural and Horticultural Society, and Active Citizenship, Clare Lions Club. In the Central Region, Citizen of the Year, congrats to Greg Brixey, and Active Citizenship, the Saddleworth Op Shop. And the Southern Area, Citizen of the Year, went to the late Trevor Overton, and congratulations to Riverton Dance, the Community Event of the Year. Staying with the wards, there are calls to reignite the Woman of Significance Award. It was originally started by the Zonta Group of Clare and Districts in 2010, but the club closed in 2018. Resident Sue Wurst would like to renew the Zonta Wall at Zonta Gardens at the northern end of Clare. Council has supported this idea. Nominations are now open and a committee is being formed to evaluate nominations and advise council. The green waste collection system has begun this month. The implementation has been met with a few complaints over the last few months, but hopefully most people are welcoming this new service.
Obviously, there's a few things like I haven't got my bin. I'm pretty sure a few people have got more than one bin. I'm pretty much sure we've distributed more bins than we have properties that we collect from. So, but anyway, Clare Valley Waste have distributed the black body bins, which are going to be the new bins that you put your recyclables in. Bit of concern about putting food scraps into the organic bin. There's plenty of a collection of FOGO collections happening, and you know the smelly bins is not an issue. You can wrap your food waste in newspaper. Don't put them in plastic. You know, those kinds of things so that, you know, they don't get too smelly. But, you know, if you don't have your bin next to your back door, it shouldn't be too big an issue. The other thing, having the 140-litre bin for rubbish collection is to encourage people, you know, to think about what they put in what bin so that if it can be composted, if it's organic, it's fine to go in the green bin, the FOGO bin. If it's a recyclable, it needs to go in the recyclable bin. And if you're doing all those things, the amount of rubbish that you should have in a fortnight should not exceed the 140-litre bin. Because the 140-litre bin is the bin that costs council, costs ratepayers money. Because that is a bin, what the contents of those bins have to go into landfill. And every time a truck of waste goes to landfill, we have to pay a levy. We pay a levy to the state government. So, you know, that's the bin that we want to keep as small as possible and the smallest amount of waste we collect, because that is just a direct hit to ratepayers. And, you know, if you're on, have a waste collect, part of the waste collection service, you pay for it. And that's separate from your waste. So we're, as council, we're moving away from subsidising waste collection through general rates. And it's, you know, you pay for that service. So any increase in the levy or the volume of waste that's going to landfill will be reflected in the waste collection levy that you have to pay. So it's in everybody's interest to try and manage their waste to ensure that waste goes into the right bin and keep that small 140-litre bin as small as possible.
So all the information is on the council website, what bin you should be using, what you can put in your bin, and also the roster as to when your bin will be collected. Everything is there in black and white and colour.
It should be, everybody should have got a calendar, so they should know when to put what bin out.
And you can print that calendar from your website as well.
Indeed, it's on the website if you haven't got it or lost it or whatever. If people have trouble trying to understand it or not sure about what goes in what bin, they can ring up council, they can ring up Clare Valley Waste, they can email us. We'll, you know, endeavour to help people as much as we can make the transition. We've got the Clare Climate Change Group, who are fabulously going to be at all the markets for the next couple of months, and they'll be happy to answer questions, and they'll deal with questions far beyond what goes in any of the bins. They'll tell you if you've got other items, they're sure to be able to tell you what other places that you can put that waste. Probably the one lots of people that are really into recycling, a mistake they make is the cartons that fruit juices and the milks, etc., that come in. A lot of people, because they do have on the packages recyclable, but they're not recyclable in South Australia, or at least certainly not for Clare Valley Waste, who collect our recyclables. So they have to go into a general waste bin. They can't go into your recycle bin.
Oh, so you like your long life milk containers.
Yeah. The little plastic tops and stuff, if you put all those tiny plastic bits and pieces into a plastic bag and put that in your recycle bin, that's fine. But those actual cartons, they're not recyclable.
I've been putting them in the recycle bin.
I think most people have, because we think they're recyclable.
Head to the council website to find out more details about the green waste collection and download the curbside collection calendar. Well, Dr. Helen McDonald, I look forward to seeing you next month, but thank you very much for the recap on what's been happening in council over the last month.
You're welcome.
While the Australia Day Awards are fresh in your mind, let's catch up with one of the winners. As I mentioned earlier, Angus Holland won the Young Citizen of the Year in the Northern Region and was presented his award at the Clare Breakfast. I caught up with him a few days later. Congratulations, Angus. How does it feel to win the Young Citizen of the Year award?
Good. Wasn't really expecting it, but I was surprised, and it was a good moment and a memory to remember.
Tell me about this fundraising initiative that you embarked on.
I was only planning to raise 1,000, but we got to 8,000, and Mum helped by setting up a GoFundMe page and doing posters and putting out cash pots.
Okay, let's back it up a bit. What did you actually do to become the Young Citizen of the Year?
Shave my head, collect the bottles around the town, and do some other fundraising with my brothers.
So you shaved your head, but you have to tell me the important part. It wasn't just any head.
Oh, my mullet.
And how long was this mullet?
I think it got to about 30 centimetres.
And how long did it take to grow 30 centimetres?
I think about 2 years.
So why did you do it? Why did you think, I reckon I can raise some money by growing a mullet?
I started and I got closer and closer each haircut, so I just grew it out.
So why did you decide though? I mean, why did you want to fundraise for, say, these two particular charities, which is the Cade McDonald Foundation and the Cancer Council?
Because I've had a couple of relatives that have gone to cancer, and I thought one that's in the valleys to put back to around us.
You grew a mullet. Your target was $1,000. Your mum established a GoFundMe page. But I understand your footy team got involved too. Tell me what happened.
Charlie Riggs organised the A-graders, and then I think there was about 8 of them, and then more and more of them were jumping on, but we didn't get to their prices that they set. And then some of my mates shaved them with me, their heads.
How many mates?
I think 4.
And for every time they shaved their head, how much money were they asking of people? So for every $1,000 you get, they shaved their head. Is that how it worked?
Yeah, some of them were jumping, some of them were like 500, and then my mates just did it with me because I raised a good amount of money.
So what did you think when you got to that $8,000 target? It was creeping closer to that.
Oh, didn't think I'd get there, but we did, and it was very surprising.
Plans to back it up, Angus? Plans to do another fundraising initiative in 2023?
Haven't thought of any yet, but it wouldn't surprise me if another one comes along.
Is this the first time that you've raised money?
Not really.
Okay, so tell me about what you've done in the past.
Me and my brothers organised like a market at Martindale Hall, like in one of the barns there. And we got like local produce and that stuff around to come to the market.
So why did you do that?
That was to raise money for a gym set that's going to be going at the Oval in Montero.
So what gets you guys, you and your brothers, to go down this path of, you know, running these fundraising initiatives? Who generates these ideas? Is it you or your brother? Or mum?
It was mum and my brothers, because I was still quite young when we first did it all. And mum helps out a lot with most of the things because she's on progress. And
well, do you reckon we should bring your mum into the discussion?
If she wants to.
Okay. All right, mum. We're here with mum Rebecca. Mum, what do you think of Angus's achievement with this particular fundraiser?
Very proud. He has done a wonderful job and works really hard, as he mentioned, with his other brothers, Matt and Zach. They've always had a headset of being community-minded and what you, have seen other people give to the community, and then you feel good by giving. And he's done a really awesome job. Very proud, but he was really supported as well by a lot of people that made it happen for him, but also for the community.
So what did you think when all the footy team decided to get on board and shave their head to try and boost the fundraising amount?
It was fantastic that the team or the club all sort of got behind it. It's a very family orientated but also very community minded club and likes giving to a cause and will jump on board. All the fellas, I think, got behind it and all enjoyed shaving each other's heads. It all became a bit of a rivalry, I think. So that was good. And then, like Angus said, on the day, four or five of his mates all got behind him and joined him as well. So just to sort of signify giving your hair for someone who might be suffering from cancer or, you know, a mental health illness is worthwhile doing.
With the Young Citizen Award, I mean, what are you going to do with that, Angus? You're going to encourage other young kids to hop on board and maybe be inspired to follow in your footsteps?
Well, they should, because it's a good memory to make and you'll keep it for your life and you'll be recognised for... It's a very big recognition.
Good answer. What about you, Beck? What do you think?
I think it's a fabulous recognition. Where to from here? I think it just inspires other people, I hope, in our community, as past recipients have done as well. I don't know, we just try to advocate giving to others makes you part of the community, but also giving to others makes you feel good inside as well.
Congratulations. Look forward to seeing how you progress with other fundraising initiatives for many years to come. Angus, so thank you.
All good.
That's 14-year-old Angus Holland and his mum, Beck, both from Mintero. And Angus is the Northern Area winner of the Young Citizen of the Year at the Australia Day Awards.
Clare Valley Podcast.
Clare Valley Podcast.
You're listening.
Clare Valley Podcast.
Clare Valley Podcast.
February 16th marks the 40th anniversary of one of the state's worst natural disasters, the Ash Wednesday bushfires.
Quite heartbreaking at times, and at one stage we thought we had it quite well contained, and we're sitting in this paddock that I thought was completely bare, and the fire just went straight through us.
But then, of course, the winds changed and came back again. That's how we lost it all.
And another fellow I knew quite well, I think he had about 2,000 or 3,000 fowls. They all went, because I can remember seeing bulldozers out there digging holes for them to go.
Unfortunately, all of our sheep got cooked in the fire. They died. Those that hadn't died, some people came through that night and later that evening and shot them, put them out of their misery, because there's no way they could be saved.
It was described as a holocaust of fire and began as a combination of 42-degree heat, 110-kilometre-an-hour winds, dust and then fire, which spread rapidly, laying to waste so much land, houses, property, stock and fences. It also came off the back of one of the worst droughts the state had ever experienced. The first call came just before 11 a.m. to a fire off West Terrace in Clare. It started at Irwin Wandle's place near the Highways Department. It was contained, but then fanned by strong southerlies, it spread quickly towards Seven Hill and Mintero. 40 CFS units were assisted by 80 private units. 9 homes were destroyed, almost 200 head of sheep killed, 190 cattle and 25 horses, but no human lives were lost. The fire was fought from 11 a.m, a wind change came through at 4:10, which prevented Clare from being endangered, and it was finally declared safe by 3:30 the following morning. There were 15 to 20 smaller outbreaks that developed over the following days. Altogether, the fire caused over $4.5 million damage and burnt approximately 6,100 hectares. John Donnellan was the CFS district officer who oversaw most of the operations. He was at the Clare headquarters that fateful day.
You know, pretty well everybody was calling out for help, as you can well imagine. So it was pretty hard to work out really, you know, if you hadn't seen an area or had first-hand knowledge of where the fire was at its worst, it was pretty hard to work out where to send some of the units. But anyway, we sort of got through it and eventually started to get it under control. Then later on, I went out on one of the units and we went down south, mainly along the Mintero Road for a start, because we were mainly at that stage trying to stop it from getting into Catalunga, because that is a nightmare, trying to fight the fire in the hills around Mintero. unfortunately there we were unsuccessful too, because the wind just blew up when we thought we had it under control there, as happened most of the day. Quite heartbreaking at times, and at one stage we thought we had it quite well contained, and we're sitting in this paddock that I thought was completely bare, and the fire just went straight through us. There was just enough dry stuff on the ground that you couldn't even really see it. And it was gone within a minute, just straight through and off, up the road, jumped the road and gone. I'd never seen anything quite like it.
I heard the visibility was shocking as well, because not only was the smoke, but the dust storms and everything else.
Well, this is one side of it, you know, that people don't sort of grasp, is the choking smoke and dust. And now and again, the wind had sort of eased off and you could sort of see. Next thing, it'd blow up again and you couldn't see anything. And a lot of the time you had no idea where the fire actually was, because all you could see was smoke and dust.
How did the fire start that day?
So power lines were clashing and sparks dropped to the ground in some dry grass. That was in the sort of western part of Clare, and it just took off from there. The first units that arrived there almost had it out, and the wind just blew up and that was gone again, which was unfortunate.
There were 9 homes that were lost all up in the fires. One of them was the historic mansion Walter Walter. We're going to bring Alistair Hope into the conversation now. Alistair was a CFS volunteer firefighter at the time and has just been awarded 60 years of service with the CFS. Alistair, thank you very much for joining me.
My pleasure.
We've seen some pretty historic and amazing photographs of Walter Walter and the devastation that occurred of your family home. Can you tell me about that moment? Were you there when
No, it was hit by the fire? I wasn't there. I joined the fire roughly down the old museum where the police paddock is. The fire unit that was at Walter Walter had a shelter in amongst the buildings. I think there was two. There's Spalding and I heard, I forget the other one, but they put everything out and they kept it under control there until some time afterwards when they discovered the leaves and so forth and the gutters had caught on fire and they would have gone up inside the roof, and it was quite some time afterwards when they discovered that the house was on fire and all of that got burnt. Part of the two-storey caught on fire between the main house and the manager's house, and they managed to put that out. That was only singed, but it was burnt right around, and then fire went on from there. The fire took a long time to get from one end of the house to the other. In that time, my father managed to get some people that were there, like fire unit and other people that come up. They couldn't get there by road. They had to be there before, because all the road and the big trees that you've got pictures of, that was on fire. That's a towering inferno, describes it very well. Those flames there would have been twice the height of the pine trees, and they were probably 70, 80 feet high.
So just going back to Walter Walter and your father, did your father stay there and fight, or did he have to evacuate?
He was there that day. Nobody could fight it, because the fire that went past, it just virtually went over the top and destroyed everything around it, trees, bush, you name it, that was gone.
What was saved?
He had some pictures, some paintings. He lost some variable things. I lost about $10,000 worth of stuff myself. Those people that were there, they took out everything that my father said of value and history to the house. And it took him a couple of weeks to get the electricians and water people to get the house livable. But he went back there and he lived in the manager's quarter, which wasn't burned down.
How was your dad after, you know, right after the fire? I mean, what was his state of mind?
Oh, he's quite positive. He said, "Now I've got something to do." Because he'd virtually retired by that time. It did give him something to do. He did a lot of going around with a metal detector trying to find various sorts of things. He knew where they were in the ashes inside. Then he got everything that they could find in the ashes. They cleaned the ashes out. Then he started demolishing plaster off the wall so they could be rebuilt. There was only one wall that went entirely. They had to rebuild that. But the rest of it was all eventually done up again. Unfortunately, he didn't see that, because he died November 1984, so that's a year and a half afterwards. But my mother, she died the year before, and my father said it's as lucky she didn't see it.
As you mentioned, you continued to fight the fire that day. Yes. What was your experience? Where were you most of that time?
I joined the fire somewhere around about the police paddock up from the National Trust there, and across to Nagleshock, and from there I short jump would have been 2 kilometres to the hill just behind the caravan park, and with the use of the portable radio I had, I was able to ring back to the fire station, ask them to ring the caravan park and tell them I was on top of the hill, get everyone out that they could, and they did. There's a lot of people saved, and their vehicles, caravans and all sorts saved because of that.
Because they all went to the showgrounds, didn't they?
Yeah, that's right.
Yep.
They're on the hill on the western side of the road there, so a lot of people were saved there. And then the fire went down past Seven Hills, a little bit past that. It's amazing it didn't go across the... There must have been not enough stuff for it to burn on the western side, so it jumped the road and it started heading for Mentero, and Jim Hackett lost a lot of land there. And then it got east of Penwortham and it started getting into the edge of Cadlunga. Unfortunately, this is where Fred Kerr, director of CFS in South Australia, he turned up that day and he stopped the fire trucks from getting in there until our unit came round. And by this time I was off a truck and I was on a fire truck by this stage, and there's a whole lot lined up, and I said, "How come you're not going in there?" our captain said. And he said, "Well, Fred stopped." I said, "The bugger, Fred." He said, "We're going in." So he opened the gate and he took it in. "If it's good enough for Clear, it's good enough for the other units," and they all followed us. And we went round in a big circle there, and a couple have braked off. We were very lucky that we stopped at getting down to Cadlunga. It bypassed us there, and it got down into Mentero. Not long after that, where the big wind change came in, instead of coming from the north, it changed round to southwest. The fire went straight from there back up towards the Clear Quarry Road. And I've got pictures, and I couldn't find them to bring in, of 3 horses that were burnt. That was sad. They were just lying there with their feet up when I got to them a couple of days later with a camera. I don't know how many hundreds of sheep, but there was a lot of sheep around that area burnt. And another fellow I knew quite well, he had about 2,000 or 3,000 fowls. They all went, because I can remember seeing bulldozers out there digging holes for them to go. And
fowls?
Yeah, chooks.
Chooks, yeah.
But it wasn't till very late in the... Well, early morning, you could call it, 3 o'clock in the morning, when it was all the boundaries of the fire were extinguished. But we still had a lot of fire units going in various places, checking it for the next couple of days. I got sent home to have a rest, the same as a lot of others, at about 4 o'clock in the morning from some of the other units from mid-north and way out during the runs during the night, just checking on places that were safe, and there was plenty of places that weren't safe. There's a whole lot of trees, logs on the ground, and all this sort of stuff still burning.
So how long was the clean-up?
The clean-up?
Weeks later?
The fire wasn't declared safe until about 3 days afterwards, probably more. I think there's 2 of us found our way into hospital.
For smoke inhalation?
Yeah, I had smoke inhalation. The other fellow had burnt eyes. He came in there with his head bandaged up, and I had smoke inhalation. When I called up into one of the first aid stations, I was come across one of the doctors that I knew there, and I said, "Hey, Doc, I'm not feeling too good." "No," he said, "get in my car." He said, "You're going straight back to hospital." Smoke inhalation's a very nasty experience because your lungs don't work, and they're sore and you can't breathe, and it takes you a couple of days on oxygen to get your lungs working. And they also warned that if you get into other serious conditions where there's a lot of smoke, he said, your lungs will be sore. And they are. That lasted for years. It didn't stop me going fires, only small fires, didn't matter. Those days we used to only have, or we'd be lucky to have 20 fires a year.
You've fought a lot of fires over the years, as you have been.
A lot.
Yeah, 60-odd years with the CFS, right?
I haven't been to an incident in about 15 years, but I still do a lot around the fire station.
What was so different about the Ash Wednesday bushfire?
The thing that stood out to all of us firefighters, it was the same sort of weather conditions as Black Sunday 15 years before. Very strong winds from the north, and you could see it on the forecast the night before. They were forecasting 40-50 knots of wind, 40-degree temperatures, and it was. Very high wind, very hot.
And a drought.
Open invitation for a firebug. Luckily, we didn't have any.
Did you have water bombers in those days?
No.
There was a discussion about some aircraft. They were fixed-wing aircraft, water bombers, but that was... overruled because it was too dangerous with the wind and all the weather conditions, so they weren't used at all.
It was a shocking day. Where you get that sort of weather conditions would probably be one every couple of years, almost the same. Luckily, with modern stuff and modern communications, as John said, the communications those days were poor. When I first joined the EFS, communication consisted of somebody writing a note and getting it back to the fire station.
There was a lot of room for improvement. I remember the former boss of the CFS, Ferg Mahon, used to say that he'd never seen a fire talked out anyway, so he was quite happy with the way things were.
Well, both of you, thank you very much for spending the time to talk to me today and sharing your stories. 40 years, do you think the public is more prepared these days for fires?
Well, I don't really, because we've got a lot more places around out in the scrub and that now where people have built that are in pretty high fire risk areas. And I don't think some of them are aware of the danger they're in. And they get plenty of warnings, but they don't seem to listen. So that's my point of view anyway.
Well, I'd thoroughly agree with that. We've got people building down on the western side of Clare in the scrub. There's no protection whatsoever. God help them. That's all I can say. If they get a fire down their area, they're in serious trouble.
Moving to Seven Hill. Two fire fronts hit the township, one from the east, which was contained, and one from the west, which did most of the damage and burnt two homes. The Seven Hill Hotel caught alight three times and fires were put out each time. Val Tilbrook was one person that lost her home. She and her daughter lived between Seven Hill and Penwortham on Tatkana Road. Val was working at H.R. Sanders, now known as Clare Rural Supplies at the time. Once the fire front went through, she quickly went back to her house to collect a few items, but unbeknown to her, the wind changed and it came back and destroyed her house.
My boss took me out on the back road to Seven Hill. He said, "Oh, if you want to get something, I'll drive you out." And I was a bit worried about that because he had a brand new Volvo car.
More worried about his vehicle than your belongings.
I was. Anyway, he took me out and by that time the fire had passed through. And so I picked up a couple of clothes for my daughter. At that time, it was only my daughter and me living there. The three boys were all working over at a winery in New South Wales. So it was only my daughter and me, and she was 13 at the time. I grabbed my jewellery box and a couple of things for her and got back in the boss's new Volvo car and back to work.
And this wasn't your home? You were renting it at the time?
Yes. Well, my boss actually owned it, yes.
And you grabbed, as you said, a jewellery box?
I think it might have been knickers and new bathers that my daughter had, something like that, because the fire had actually passed the house. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, the wind changed and it came back again. So that's how we lost it all. Mm.
Also, at that point when you got out there, it was fine.
Yes, yes, yes. And I thought, oh, I don't need to take that much. I didn't think of photos, of course. But anyway, I got back to work and then we found out the wind had changed and the house and the whole property, which was on a vineyard, was gone. My young boss, Roger Sanders, who was in the SES at the time, I remember he came and into work because he had been out helping fight the fire, and he came into work and said, "Oh, please sit down and I'm sorry to tell you that your house is gone."
What goes through your mind when you get news like that?
I think I was just numb. So I had to think about that for a while, yeah.
So when did you go back out again to see the actual damage?
I think it must have been the next day.
And what did you do when you went out there?
Well, just actually looked around a bit, and I had a piano and an organ, and all you could see was all these wires and strings, etc., etc. And there was really no sign of any furniture. That was all quite burnt up. Mm.
So how was the recovery? What did you do after that? How did you put one foot in front of the other and keep going?
Well, I stayed with my friend who took me out there the next day. I stayed with him and his daughter because she was about the same age as my daughter. Stayed with them for 5 months until I got my house where I am now in Kelly Street. And that was a public trustee house, and Brian Edwards, who was a friend of mine, pushed it along so I didn't have to wait too long to get in there. Mm.
How was your daughter?
It took her a long time to get over it, and she still remembers things because she was 13 years old, just an awkward age. And when we went back a few days later, she scrambled amongst the dirt and she found a lovely bracelet that my mother-in-law had given her many years ago. And so she still has that, treasures it.
Well, Val, thank you so much for taking the time to have a chat to me today. I really appreciate it and getting to hear your story. So thank you.
My pleasure.
Tens of thousands of livestock were left without feed. 105 hectares of vineyards were burnt, with Clare Valley winemakers claiming that vineyards acting as firebreaks saved 20 to 30 houses from destruction. It's estimated the 1983 vintage of 5,000 tonnes was reduced by over 900 tonnes. Neil Paulette and his wife Alison had only been living in the Polish Hill River region for 6 months. They'd moved from the Hunter Valley to start up a wine business, which, as you may know, is called Paulette Wines. That stinking hot day, Neil was working with Martin Smith, a local landholder and contractor, and noticed the massive plume of smoke to the northwest. He and Martin went off fighting the fires, not knowing only in a few hours his land, stock and vineyards would too be destroyed. This is Neil's story. And just a word of warning, some of the content mentioned can be distressing.
We had 117 acres. We had about, I'll talk acres, 47 hectares, but acres. We had about 13 acres of vines that were very, very valuable. It's because of my contact in earlier days, I'd worked for Penfolds and they were going to buy the grapes. So we had an income coming from the grapes. Most of it was more sherry type varieties, Bianco, thing they call Bianco, White Grenache, Pedro. There was some Mouvedre or Mataro, some Shiraz and Riesling that we were quite keen to utilise for ourselves. But through my earlier contacts, they were going to buy, and we were selling through Clarevale, that they operated at that time, Clarevale Cooperative. We were going to sell grapes for a few years. They were happy to take them to help us out, really, which is fantastic. Yeah, we've discussed this, either 115 or 119 sheep, ewes. Because of the drought, we'd bought them from Jamestown Market, and they were beautiful young ewes. We also bought three beautiful young rams, magnificent rams, from what's now Canala, down Auburn way, because no one was buying sheep. They were selling for nothing. This property hadn't been grazed for a couple of years, so there was plenty of dry fodder here. They were getting close to lambing, the ewes, so the fire did come through. The cottage that we weren't living in, actually, where Martin had, when we purchased the place, we rented the cottage to the people we bought from for a year, and they stayed for the year before they left. They were here, but we were in another accommodation just up the road a bit that Martin and Joan had organised for us.
And that was saved?
That was saved.
So
yeah.
Your house was saved, but you lost everything.
Yeah, well,
else.
With the fire, it came through. The cottage was surrounded by pine trees. A crew from Penfold saw the fire coming and they came in to protect the house. But when the fire pine trees started to explode, they got out. Anyway, we drove down about another 100 metres where there was a bit of a gap in the trees, and fire wasn't so intense and we could see where things were, and then we drove back and back in. It was quite eerie. It was almost still in there, even though the wind was roaring, but the wind was changing at that stage, actually. It had swung round to the south. An orange, really, really orange, just from the flames, and the colour was quite amazing. So it was a bit hot outside, so we went into the house and waited in there till things calmed down a bit. Then got outside. It was interesting what we had in mind for our cellar door. There's a carport there, and behind that was an old shearing shed. And next to that was a blacksmith shop. I had that in mind as a cellar door. Well, that all burnt. That was destroyed. And I often regret the fact that in the shearing shed there was some... It was belt-driven, an old diesel motor drove belts on around these pulleys, but the pulleys were made from timber, just beautiful handcrafted timber pulleys that I thought they were just magnificent, but anyway, they disappeared in the fire. So we lost that. We lost a couple of sheds, lost all the pine trees, unfortunately all of our sheep got cooked in the fire. They died. Those that hadn't died, some people came through that night and later that evening and shot them, put them out of their misery because there's no way they could be saved. And when they came, someone came along with a backhoe and dug a hole and buried them, and a lot of the ewes split open and they were carrying twins and triplets, so it would have been magnificent, but anyway, it wasn't to be.
Oh, Neil, that would have just been devastating.
I suppose it was quite numbing in a lot of respects. But after the event, that upset me a lot when people would pull up on the road and were taking photos, and I thought, well, of just the ruins, there's a house sitting there amongst all the debris of sheds and trees and the like, and that was a bit upsetting. But I don't know. We just it had happened. We just move on.
How do you recover from something like that?
Not quite sure. We were a bit lucky as the wind changed. Our Riesling and Shiraz were on the southern southeastern end of the vineyard area. Everything else got cooked. Unripe berries like Pedro, they ended up being like sultanas. They were just shriveled and quite tasty, actually. There were a row of trees, a lot of pear trees out in the vineyard, and some walnuts. Trees, they all got burnt to smithereens. Well, they didn't. They just got severely burnt. But we were lucky that with the wind change, the Riesling in particular was saved. The Shiraz got scorched, but not to the point of having to be removed, where all the other was.
You had to remove everything else.
Yeah, everything else gone. So we actually had a vintage from 83. And we were blessed in some respects.
Wasn't smoke tainted? That didn't matter?
Well, no one talked about smoke taint
back in those
days,
didn't they? Oh,
no,
right, okay.
No, we were blessed in that we had a wonderful group of friends through the Smiths that came along and volunteered their day, and we picked the Riesling. The Shiraz was too far gone, too much scorched berries in that to pick.
How big was that vintage?
357 cases. I've got Alison sitting with us who...
to fact check everything. Yeah. Should we bring Alison into the conversation now? Because Alison, your wife, you're a nurse. Were you on deck that day?
I went to Minterra School because Matthew was there and he was asking where we were. So I went to Minterra School and we were evacuated to Farrell Flat, Oval. People were there in thongs. One lady had a bird in a cage. It was just like, after some time we were allowed home and I had absolutely no idea where Neil was because no mobile phones or any of those things in those days, but he eventually turned up home with very, very sore eyes, which he always has, but they were incredibly sore that day.
Oh,
oh yeah.
So how did you feel when you went home and saw what you saw?
You just sort of think, oh, here we go. It's just something else. But we had nowhere else to go, so we had to stay and try and make something of it.
You'd only been there 6 months. Did you think, oh, we may as well just pack our bags and go home, go back to Muswellbrook?
No, we didn't because, well, we'd sold everything up there. But, I don't know, 2 weeks after that we had floods. Everything just poured off the side of the hill. There's that much rain. And it just went, and that went through the cottage twice. The people who were renting just opened the front door and the back door and let it go through. Fortunately, the floors were concrete. So we had that, and then we thought, well, another 2 weeks we'll have insects.
A plague of locusts, yeah.
I don't know what we do, but somehow we survived.
So let's talk about the recovery. How long did it take you to get back on track, or some normality at least?
Oh, yeah, that's a difficult one. Probably 40 years, probably still trying to get back to normality. No, I don't know, it's probably a year, maybe. I picked up a job at Stanley Winery as a cellar hand. So I went in there and we generated a bit of income. I worked as a cellar hand, which was good for a while. and that was for vintage. Then Martin's work picked up with fencing. He did a lot of fencing contracting and vineyard trellising. Well, there was a lot of that to be done after the fires, so his work picked up. So I went back, and thankfully his family was so supportive in those early days. That gave us an income. It wasn't a big income, but we got through.
So when did you start to replant and get the vineyards back up and running to the capacity that you had before?
Well, it took a long time to get to that. When we moved across, we'd talk with Martin. He had a vineyard and we'd committed to taking his grapes. So they'd survived the fire. We didn't take them in 83, but 85, I think, onwards, we started to take those grapes. We started extending the Shiraz and Riesling area. I borrowed a tractor and pushed out everything else that was dead. When did we start? 85 we started replanting, I think.
85.
Mm. So extended the vineyard and just kept extending on from there. Mm. Would have liked to have recovered the Mervedra or the Mataro. I still have that in mind. There's one vine survived, and I took some sticks from it, but I haven't continued on with that. Actually, I'd forgotten about it. So I've got some sticks to...
2023 is the year.
Yes. I'm thinking it probably took us about five to get back to somewhere. In essence, I think the setback was so much that you probably never regain that anyway. You get back to where you were, but you're probably still 3 or 4 years behind. And I think that's been the case all the way through. No matter how good things might become, that those setbacks they put you into a debt cycle, because you've got to borrow then to develop things. I think they just hold you back more than maybe you would have if it hadn't have happened.
How much land do you have now? How many hectares of vines do you have now?
We've got now about 500 acres of land and about 100 hectares of vines.
100 hectares of vines.
But
and
we've
started with how many?
We started with maybe 6 hectares. Mm. Wow. Oh, no, 5 hectares.
That's impressive.
Well, it's 40 years.
Still, at least you went in that direction.
We did, yeah. Upwards and onwards, one hopes. Yes.
Alison, I might bring you in here at the end. What's your perspective on how Neil recovered from that?
Well, I guess it's a little bit like Neil said. We just got on with it. We never thought we couldn't cope, and I never thought he couldn't cope. And I think it's probably just the same old story. We just had to move on. And
were there nights around the kitchen table where you just were looking at each other going, okay,
right now,
what do we do now?
I've probably been more like that than Neil. Plenty of times where I've sort of thought, let's go and do something else. It's tough. It's been tough. Tough for a lot of people. But I don't know. He's just got on with it. We've battled on.
I'm a constant optimist.
It's Neil and Alison Paulette. CFS units came from right across the Mid-North, York Peninsula and Eyre Peninsula to help fight and mop up the fires. Bushfire relief came in the form of fodder donations, labour, food supplies, clothing and accommodation. If you'd like to find out more details about the Ash Wednesday bushfires, head to my show notes and click on the Volunteer Brigade Journal. There you'll read a fascinating and detailed account of what happened in Clare and other areas of the state that devastating day. Also, check out my Facebook and Instagram feeds to see some amazing historical photographs that have been submitted by those interviewed on this podcast. A big thank you to John, Alastair, Val, Neil and Alison for your assistance with this story and your candid accounts and photographs. Also, thank you to the Clare History Group for their historical Northern Argus newspaper articles. And thank you to Travis, a member of the public, who brought this story to my attention in the first place. This podcast was brought to you by the Clare and Gilbert Valleys Council. I'm Annabelle Homer. I'll catch you soon for another episode of the Clare Valley Podcast.